Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a building gets knocked down, its wooden boards and beams typically get destroyed too. In the U.S., tens of millions of tons of lumber end up in landfills or incinerators each year. But Eric Law of the company Urban Machine says much of this wood could be reused instead.
So it's a massive amount of material that's still high-quality material. It's still completely intact. It's still got good length to it.
Before it can be reused, though, all the nails, screws, and staples must be removed.
And that process is incredibly labor-intensive.
So Law's company created a robotic machine that's now in use near San Francisco. It locates metal fasteners in pieces of lumber and extracts them using pincers. It can process thousands of feet of material each day. He says making it more efficient to reuse lumber could pay off for builders and the climate. Trees absorb and store carbon. When they're used for lumber, much of the carbon remains locked away in the wood. But if the wood decays in a landfill or is burned, it releases climate-warming pollution. Reusing lumber helps limit that pollution, and it means fewer new trees need to be cut down, so it could reduce the construction industry's impact on the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Welcome to New Dimensions Radio. Today we turn our attention to the future, how we imagine it, how we design for it, and how we can shape it with intention. In a world of rapid change, the ability to constructively engage with uncertainty is a vital skill, one that allows us to craft futures that are not just possible, but preferable. Joining us are Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley, leaders at Stanford's Design School, and experts in the art and science of design. Together, they explore how we can imagine the future by embracing creativity, adaptability, and strategic foresight. Their book, Assembling Tomorrow, serves as both a guide and an invitation to engage with the future as something we actively build rather than passively inherit. Join us for the next hour as we uncover how design thinking can help us not only anticipate what's ahead, but actively shape it in ways that align with our values and aspirations. I'm your host, Travis Glenn Sabera. Welcome to New Dimensions. And a warm welcome to you, Carissa, Scott.
Thanks, Travis Glenn. It's wonderful to be here.
Thanks.
So good to see you. I wanted to start off our talk today referencing a quote that you have in the book from Michael Beirut. He says, to call design a sacred calling is not overkill. The things we make shape the way we think. The way we think colors the experience of being alive. What's more sacred than that? So I'd like to hear a little bit from each of you about how this understanding of design shaped your process for working together and writing the book.
I love that quote. I think it's important to me and when I work with Scott to remember that we always bring ourselves to everything we make, right? You always show up in your work, no matter what. So remembering all of those elements and how it comes into it and how I show up in my collaboration with him and all of the experiences that stacked up into our lives to date, that's what made this book for me and this collaboration with me and Scott from my side. I'd love to hear what Scott would say.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. We both teach students in design, right? So we're not just practicing designers, but we're teachers as well. And, you know, when you're teaching, you're helping change the way people think, which changes the way people act. And I think it's not taken into account quite enough how much the things we make also sort of teach us, right? How, you know, the way our environment might be constructed really shapes what we notice and what we don't. Who we're around shapes what we notice and what we don't. And the things that we notice, the things that we give attention to, those become the things that guide us. Those become the things that sort of communicate with other people. And so I think in writing the book and in working at the D School, it's a lot about putting things out into the world that shape the way we are.
I really like hearing that, not only that you two are teachers and professors offering this to the world, but you're also staying curious and taking a learning orientation yourself. And I'm reminded in the book too, you two say, don't try to figure out who you think which one of you two wrote which part of it, either or contributed to that.
We'll see if you can by the end,
yeah.
Travis.
Ryan, that sounds good. Yeah, you stopped me doing that from reading it. But when I go back now, I think I'm going to try to do that a little more. Great. Well, let's jump into one of the main topics, and that's the idea of runaway design. And it was a bit unfamiliar term for me. And so I'm wondering if we can tease that out for our listeners a bit, if we reference that more.
You say runaway design, because if you think about the technologies that we're making with today, and those are technologies like AI, like synthetic biology, so the ability to edit and hack together genetic code, those are some of the technologies that are at the top of the news in terms of what people are building tools with. They're also wildly fast. They scale really quickly, and they go on to make after we release them into the world. And it's that making beyond our human control that is the runaway part. So when our creations go on to create after us, they cause many effects, both first order our intended effects, but then other second order consequences as well. And if we're not careful as creators in shepherding those runaway design type technologies forward, we could see the effects that happen with something like a runaway train where it derails, goes off the tracks and cause some sort of destruction. The thing that's scary about this runaway design world is those technologies are invisible to the naked eye, right? And with a train, you can see that it has maybe crashed. But when one of these technologies goes awry, we only see the destruction that it's caused. So we want to promote making in this runaway design world in a way that's both optimistic but responsible alongside of it.
Yeah, and Travis Glenn, you might not have been familiar with that term because that's a term that Carissa Carter made up for this book.
Wow.
I mean, we had the idea together, but that term was coined by Carissa. And another thing that Carissa really kind of isolated in this book is the idea that everything breaks, right? And so that anything we make, where let's say you make a car, the car's going to break down eventually, the train's going to break down eventually. And it seems that when we build a software, we don't necessarily take that breaking into account, right? It should be part of the design process that you're also designing the failures. Meaning, if something fails, you're kind of ready for it, or you've built in a contingency to do something about it. Because the fundamental thing about runaway design is how interconnected everything is. These new technologies technologies that Carissa mentioned, you know, synthetic biology, AI, they're tangling relationships in the world that weren't really connected before, right? Our sort of brains are now connected with computers. Our genetics are gonna be connected with technology. And that creates these weird relationships. And that's why everything feels like it's kind of going haywire at once.
It's true, like you said, that we're not only designing the ship, but we're also designing the shipwreck at the time, too. And that happens. You know, when we talk about design, too, is the term not only runaway design. And so you've completely opened up my mind to everything is designed. Everything is created. And so I'm actually walking around with a new lens on the world, thinking of what design is. And so I really appreciate that. And especially this notion that things break and we have to have the next design.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the deal, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things is, as I said, it's changed my thinking about design. And one of the big parts that you really make a case for is that we have to consider the emotions when we're designing something. And as designers, as creators, what emotions are we putting into something? Even if we're putting in a prompt to AI, we think we're putting in content, but we're also revealing something that may be true about us emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to think about that is like everything that we create is kind of an extension of our psyche, right? And I don't mean that in a mystical way. I just mean like the biases that I bring to something are going to land in the thing that I make. The reason I might, you know, be a graphic designer versus an architect is because my psyche is inclined to one or the other. So we're really creating things and putting them out into the world that are representations of who we are. So you have to think about that at every level, right? And I think in particular, I'll speak personally, sometimes it's hard to keep track of your emotions, but there's a lot of research, a guy down at USC named Antonio Damasio, who's really fascinating, looks at decision-making and how much emotions factor into decision-making. And it's a lot. And when you sit down and think about it, in fact, the emotions are there to help you make the decision. The emotions actually help you take the data or the input that you're recognizing and give you a reason to make a decision in one direction or another. So they're just so important in the way that things go out to the world. And, you know, you can look at, I don't know, people who are famous for making, are they always emotionally well-adjusted? And do we want them to be more emotionally well-adjusted? Would that lead to a better world? And it's kind of easy to see that the answer is probably yes, but you know, on all counts, you know, but it's just a really critical thing that humans have emotions and emotions help us create.
And with this inseparable part of design, whether we're aware of it or not, I'm wondering what you two encounter as professors of graduate students with this notion. Do the students come in thinking they're also emotional, or how readily do they accept that they have to include this in their work?
Well, that's something we actually lean into with them. So focusing on the human behavior and really isolating the need and the minute human experience that may create the opportunity for design work is actually what we're trying to zero in on with them in their projects, right? So it's not, we don't start from the place of, hey, I have this new material and it bends in a funky way that nothing has bent before. I wonder what we could use it for. That is a fantastic way to approach problems, and we need people to be doing that. But with our students, we say, hey, we want you to be bending that material. We also want you to spend a week shadowing a person and watching how they move through their day and really understanding the nuances of what it means to be them in this moment and what decisions do they have to make. So we really want them to register what those emotions are and what's the context for it and how can you build from it.
That's a fantastic idea. I was about to ask one thing we might invite our listeners to do in their lives to understand this concept better, maybe with some caution or some skill, to just observe other people.
I mean, a really fun device for that is to have somebody give you a tour of your city block And one of our colleagues, Susie Wise, was the first person that I ever heard this activity from, but she calls it expert tours. And so essentially, if you take a walk around the block with somebody who is an astronomer, right, the things that they will notice and point out as they walk around that block is different than somebody who is a father, right, and walks around the block and points out their perspective on, oh, wow, well, I avoid these cracks because it gives a little bump at the stroller over here. Whereas the astronomer might be pointing out, oh, hey, like when it gets dark here, you can see Orion perfectly from this vantage point, right? So you have the same place, but different experiences going through it, and it will allow you to see how we all experience the world acutely differently.
I'm speaking with Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley, co-authors of Assembling Tomorrow. If you want to learn more about their work, go to dschool.stanford.edu/books, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. We're talking about how to consider design as we go through our daily lives. We've mentioned some of the newer technologies, AI and biotech. And so I'm wondering how focusing on design can reduce the risks that may be inherent in these developing technologies.
Yeah, we'd like to talk about synthetic biology, say, as artificial evolution, right? Because that's what it is, if you think about it. In the same way, AI, artificial intelligence, is mimicking our brains, while we're speeding up evolution with synthetic biology. And when you look at the word artificial, what does artificial actually mean? It just means human made. That's it. So we're the ones making this stuff. In a weird way, even the people making the stuff, if you listen to, say, people talk about AI who are the builders of it, they also sound like they don't know what's going to happen and it's a little bit out of control, right? But if you think about it as, well, the thing that we're making, we are making, and what responsibility do we bear as we're making it? So there are a few different things that you can do. One very tactical one comes from a book called Tragic Design that we also mentioned in our book. And it's about setting what they call anti-goals. So an anti-goal is not just setting, here's what I want this thing to do, but at the beginning, you also say, here's what I don't want it to do. So we're going to create something that does this and doesn't do that. And then you kind of have to hold yourself accountable. And I think there's a concern that we can't predict what these things are going to do, and we can't, but we can anticipate what we don't want them to do. That's actually not very hard, right? So saying like, well, I don't want artificial intelligence to be able to pretend it's a human, or I don't want artificial intelligence to, you know, create a situation where a child is put into a mental health crisis. Now, it's complicated to design it not to do that, but it's not hard to articulate it, what we don't want things to do.
I like this idea of the anti-goal. And along with this is the notion of constraints. And you write that to have an elegant response in relationship to our constraints. And I actually heard this as something very joyful, that it's the attitude in which we honor the constraints. And you tie this into somehow reflecting that our constraints are tied in with our ethics or our morality. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the boundaries that we put on the work that we do, like, well, that's what a constraint really is. And your constraints could be something that is simple, like you have a time constraint. But you could also say, I'm going to constrain myself and work with one material. I'm going to constrain myself and make sure that what I'm creating always is something that does no harm to the environment along the way. When you are deciding to undertake any project of bringing something to the world, by taking the time ahead of time to define, to, we call it designing your design work, right? To we all want to make the utmost perfect thing, right? And cause no harm, create you know, something wonderful. But when we take the time to really focus on what are the top three to five constraints that are realistic for me in the time that I have at hand, that both leverage what talents I have as the creator, but also what I will and won't do. That's where the values come in, right? That's where if I want to create a design that foregrounds the needs of my descendants 100 years from now, if I'm thinking with that longevity of time, that's going to affect what I'm building, right? That's going to affect every lens through which I look at every iteration of what I'm creating. So that's what we mean by pulling in your values to the constraints of the project at hand.
I really, really deeply appreciate that we're jumping right here into the second half of the book, almost the ending, really, and we're working our way backwards. And as such, I wanted to ask you then, Carissa, you talked about doing no harm or designing for least harm as we're doing. And when I was reading the book, I was working backwards also with technology, AI. But then before that, what we hear about is social media. And I'm wondering, social media, the cachet and the likes and the views are now require video. And just 5 years ago, it was just about still photos. And then we had the internet. And before that, there was the radio and then television. And you even go back to the printing press as technology that was designed that had benefit, but also caused harm in other arenas too. So we're always having to play catch up with something we invent, it seems like.
That's absolutely true, right? And there's no reason to expect that that won't continue to be the case. However, given that we can now cite all of these examples where, you know, we followed the hubris that we bring to every new creation into the world and the excitement of the possibilities of what might be, and then we can look back and say, hey, that caused a lot of harm. Like, now that we've seen so many cycles of that, we should be doing that concurrently with the technologies we're releasing now. Scott does this example that he shares. He talks about how the amount of time gap between when a technology is released and the effects of that technology are felt and realized, you know, that's the runaway design moment, like the runaway design realization. He shows how that is getting faster and faster, right? And that kind of intuitively makes sense. You know, social media takes about, you know, 10 years for us to really feel the effects of how that has harmed people, you know, in many ways in interactions between children, etc. But, you know, with AI, like, we're feeling those effects almost instantly, right? So we all know that we're feeling that rate of things speeding up.
So in a way, we're able to apply Moore's law to demonstrating the effect. As technology increases, the impact happens more rapidly as well.
I never thought of it that way, but I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's sort of like the social and environmental impact, a Moore's law version of that.
Yeah. I like the examples where we get to go back in history too. And there was in the book about a river being on fire.
It's the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, which is sort of like the main downtown river. And in the 70s or the late 60s, well, actually it lasted for a while, but it was being so polluted that it kept lighting on fire to the tune of, like, back then, you know, imagine in the 50s, I think there was one fire that caused $1.5 million worth of damage in the 50s, you know, but they just kept going. And this was a function of, you know, it was a big factory town and they were just like unloading everything into the river. And the fire itself was just this representation of the river reaching its limit, right? Like we tended to, in the beginning of the industrial age and deep into it, feel like we just had unlimited resources and we could do whatever we wanted. And the earth was so big, it would never, you know, how could we humans even cause any damage to the earth? But then as you reach the limits, you start to get, you know, rivers on fire, which is sounds like an oxymoron. And it actually, there was a photo in Time magazine. You know, Time magazine at the time was like tens of millions of readers. You know, there's only a few news outlets. There was this huge impact just from a photo of the fire. And that directly led in terms of timing and influence and how people were talking about it to the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency under Richard Nixon, by the way. So like you can see that a lot of these impacts are invisible. And then when they're visible, we start to care about them. But the cause of that was happening, you know, decades before it was visible.
Right.
And so we do need to get more nimble because the visibility, as Chris was describing, like the speed at which the effects are showing up is happening faster and faster. So we actually have to get better at dealing with the effects more quickly because otherwise we're just going to create these flaming rivers, you know, metaphorically in our minds, in our social situations, in our politics.
And you talk with that as the visibility happens, what we're pointing to is a kind of measurability and the ability to measure impact. And you also make a point, we measure something, but measuring also shows us what we're missing.
I mean, I'll also say that what we measure shows what we value. That was what popped in my head too when you brought up measurements. I'm always wary of them because the minute we decide on what those metrics are, yes, that's important. We can show progress. We can see that we've missed things, but also that we're putting a stake in the ground with what's valuable and what isn't. And that's important to pay attention to as well.
And the fact that some things are easier to measure than others, right?
Yes. So,
and a lot of the things that are difficult to measure are extremely impactful. So, you know, they even right now to this point haven't totally shown a perfect causal effect of social media on teen depression, right? But we all feel like that's real. But it's very hard to measure because it's sort of this like relational thing. There's so many impact. Just think about how we deal with nutrition, right? Like, because there's so many influences on the body, it's very hard to track diet and the effects of diet. You know, there's some data that we have that's very clear, but other data is really hard to find. So sometimes we over-index on the things we can see just because we can see them, not because they're what's worth seeing.
I so appreciate that. We want the simplistic knowledge that something might be monocausal. We have a hypothesis, we measure that, and we can say this is or isn't it. But there might be 20, 30, 40 other variables that are also need to be in a consideration.
Absolutely. There's a quote in the book from Gregory Bateson, who's like very early on in thinking about how systems work together. And it basically boils down to the fact that the way nature works is different than the way people think. And that is the fundamental source of all the problems we're having. And, you know, the way nature works is very intertwined and interconnected and very hard to see, like, which is the perfect thing that's causing that thing. And the way we think is very much in stories, which are very dramatic and very monocausal, right? This person said that and it made me do this and then that happened. And so we have this sort of tendency to want to simplify things into these dramatic conflicts when the real way that they work is through hidden interconnections that influence each other. And so that disconnect is just causing a lot of trouble for us, I think.
And that you bring up in the book too, that disconnect is precious and innocent in a way that when we buy into and we share the same story, it's our sense of belonging. And so right. We actually can't include the full truth if our goal is also to belong.
Right. Yes. Sometimes lies help us belong much better than truth does. Right.
Something else that was drawn to my attention, and we can talk about it more in the next segment, is the idea that design is not only an additive, but it could be a subtractive process as well to get to where we want to go. I'm speaking with Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley, co-authors of Assembling Tomorrow. If you want to learn more about their work, go to dschool.stanford.edu/books. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. And I wanted to hear a little bit more on the process of design, to not only think of it as an additive process, but something that may also be subtractive.
Yeah, one of my favorite